Hello.
There he is.
Hi. Welcome. Okay. This is copied from Strive for Truth by Rabbi E.E. Dessler. Strive for Truth is a partial English translation of his letters that he wrote to his students during the Second World War while he was separated from his family. Thanks.
Awesome. And they're like broken up into little books, and is it like book one?
You've seen it broken into six books. Yeah. So you've seen it. So the first three are is Strive for Truth, and the last three are different essays on the Parsha and on things that happened in Jewish history. So this is from book two, volume two of Strive for Truth.
And what's his name?
E.E. Dessler. D-E-S-S-L-E-R. Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler. So Rabbi Dessler was one of the foremost Mussar teachers and thinkers of the 20th century. And he, like many great Jewish thinkers, went through a lot of adversity, but his particular piece was the war. But not as a, he wasn't, he was separated from his family during the war. So he went to England on a fundraising trip and then wasn't able to go back to Eastern Europe where his family is from. So they escaped to Australia. So his trial wasn't going through the hardships of war necessarily, but being separated from his family, I think, for 9 years until they were able to be back together. So during that time, anybody who's a workaholic knows he was able to accomplish a lot. He was a workaholic, and he didn't have a family to take care of because he couldn't. So he really, he traveled from England to, from London to Manchester, and he basically slept on the train. So he didn't even like have to have a place to sleep. He just slept in between cities where he went to teach, and he fundraised, and he started yeshiva, and he started Gateshead Yeshiva, which today is a premier yeshiva in England. But he saw the destruction in Eastern Europe, and it was his, he felt it was his duty to bring Torah to Western Europe, where there wasn't really. You know, the real Torah institutions only existed in Lithuania and Poland and Russia, and there wasn't really anything in England or America yet, real Torah. But he brought it to England. So he wrote lots of letters, and he typed them. He typed them and he wrote them with carbon copies so he could send them out to his students. So he would press hard and write, you know, a few copies and send them in different directions. So his Michtav Me'Eliyahu, that book means the letter, Eliyahu's letters. So these are the different letters that he wrote as lessons to his students during the war. And so there's a partial translation of some of the letters in Strive for Truth. So this particular letter is the Discourse on Free Will, and there's four different sections, and it's only part of it is translated into English, but this chunk is translated. So this is the piece that we talked about last week where he comes up with this concept of point of choice, the choice point, however you want to say it, Nikudat HaBechira. So we discussed that a little bit, and we'll discuss it again this week, but I want to bring the article. Maybe we'll get a chance to actually look at it. I'll try to fill in that smoking story. That must be my fault that I didn't turn the pages properly while I copied it at home, because everything I think that I brought got copied. So I apologize for that. It's an interesting story, and it's an important part. Maybe I'll try to send it in next week so you can just add that in, even though I won't be here. Oh, next week you won't be here either, because it's right before Thanksgiving, but the week after that. I'll try to send it in so Stella can copy it and give you that, so you have that page. Right. Or maybe I'll learn how to scan and I can email it to you. I'll get a different skill going here. Okay. So this is what I want to talk about. So last week we talked about the nature of free will, and this week I want to talk about the nurture of free will. So in order to do that, we have to review a little bit of nature and add on to a little bit of nature and discuss some things that we didn't discuss last week. So first of all, I just want to renew that vocabulary word that's important to remember, bechira, or bechira. So depending on how you pronounce it, if you're pronouncing it with an Israeli accent, as I often pronounce things, or the American, more yeshivish accent, as you might hear it more often from teachers in this class. So the Israeli accent would be bechira. The yeshivish accent would be bechira. Okay? The yeshivish accent will have an S. The Israeli accent will have a T. For that top letter, Shabbos, Shabbat, right? That letter flips. So you'll see here, Bechira Chofshit or Bechira Chofshis, depending on how you pronounce it. But I just want you to hear it in both ways so that you'll recognize it when you hear it other times. Because this is a word that's used in philosophic discussions, or you might hear on a tape if you borrow a tape or whatever, MP3 from the library, Bechira. So we didn't discuss a few of these things here, a few of the verses that I put on top. And by verses, I don't mean psukim, I mean verses. So Bechira, Chofshit, Bechira. Bechira Chofshit means free will, free choice. Right? It's idiomatically translated as free will, but will really in Hebrew is ratzon, like desire, will. This is Bechira, choice, livchor, to choose. We're the Am HaNivchar, the chosen nation, that comes from the choose word, the choose root. So Bechira is choice, and often it could be fully expressed, free choice, Bechira Chofshit, or it's just idiomatically said Bechira, and you're assuming that means free choice, even though you're just saying choice. So, Bechira versus destiny. So how does that work? If there is a destiny, and we do believe that there is an ultimate destiny, bless you, there's an ultimate destiny towards which we're headed, the whole world is headed, and perhaps we as individuals are headed as well to a destiny, how does free will work in that, right? Let's just develop the question more, Bechira versus God's omnipotence. If God can do anything, how does free will for us individually work? Right? And free will versus God's omniscience, which I looked up to make sure I spelled this right, right? Because it looked like omniscience here to me. I'm not a speller. So, Bechira versus God's omniscience. This is God's all-knowingness. Omniscience means all-knowingness. So if God knows everything, how can we have free will? Right? How do we have free choice? And finally, hashgacha pratis, or hashgacha pratit, depending on how you pronounce it. Hashgacha pratis, how does that exist? So God's divine providence, God's intervention in our life. How does that work with free will? So there's really four different questions here. God's going from the bottom up now. God's intervention in our life. So the specific intervention in an individual level in our life. God's all-knowingness, God's all-power, and destiny, the concept of destiny. How does all that work with free will? How do we have free will when we know that those things are in effect also? So that's a question that I want to look at here. Okay, how will we look at that is the question. So it's not a class on destiny. It's not a class on God and God's nature. So we can't fully go into that. So for the sake of this class, we're just going to have to assume that there is a destiny. God is all-powerful. God does know everything. And there is divine intervention into our lives. We're going to close it, even though it's hot, right? It is so hot in here.
I know.
Yeah. But no, you can close the door because it's distracting. It's probably not going to make it hotter. Okay. So God does know everything, but he moves aside for us to be able to have free choice. The concept of God's all knowledge and free choice actually is one of the conundrums that we're told by our sages we shouldn't consider too much. We have to know that they both exist simultaneously, and they do, and there's lots of sagacious sayings that bring that up, and yet it's too difficult for us to contemplate. So I have a little parable that I use, which helps a drop, but not all the way. So I think we've talked about parables before, maybe not with this group, but a parable basically is one example of something. And from that, you have to bring it out into something more. So, for instance, somebody who hasn't seen the ocean. So you could say, well, have you seen a bathtub? Yes. Or maybe a swimming pool? Yes. Well, it's like a swimming pool, but a lot bigger. That doesn't tell you what the ocean really looks like, you know? But if you've never seen the ocean, maybe you could go to a lake. Have you seen a lake? It's like a lake, only it covers all of Colorado. Have you seen a lot of space? You might have to put together a few different things to help them get the image of what it is. You've seen a plane. I mean, like the planes, right? You've flown over the planes, landing at DIA. You've seen a lake. Imagine that lake covered that whole area and was bigger. So that's really what a parable is you still don't actually know what it is, but it's an example of things that you do have familiarity with to help you get an idea of something that you don't have familiarity with. But they don't work all the way, like this one doesn't, okay? So in order to get the all-knowingness, or knowing the future and allowing free will at the same time, imagine a child comes to you before dinner, right? Somebody that you know well, and says, I'm hungry. And you offer them something that you know they don't like, Brussels sprouts, right? Pick something you know they don't like, and chocolate kisses, right? Now you offer both in your hand. Would you like a Brussels sprout or a chocolate kiss? They get to pick. You know what they're going to pick, right? You know which one they're going to choose, and you can make it stronger, something that's disgusting, a mud ball and a chocolate kiss. You know what they're going to pick to eat, but that doesn't invalidate, your knowledge does not invalidate their ability to choose at that moment. So again, it's a parable. It doesn't work all the way out, but it can help us understand that God can know and we can choose at the same time. Now, God knows what we're going to choose. So he knows everything, and it makes it difficult for us to understand that we do have free will and we get to pick as we go through our lives what we do. But it's a conundrum. But God has much more of a brain than we do, or doesn't even have a brain, so it's much bigger than that. So God is able to hold all those details all at once, and there's no past, present, or future for God. It's all present. So for God, it's the destruction of the temple and the Spanish Inquisition and the era of Messiah and the first space liftoff and the creation of the world and Egypt all at once. So it's also not something that we can hold in our brains all at once. You know, we have to think linearly. Time was a creation that God made so that we would be able to make our way through the world and see things in a sequential modality so that we could process it according to who we are in our nature. But God doesn't need time. God is above time. So God does know everything. For us, God is dead, and we are dead, and we're being born at the same time. You know, so we're taking our first breath and our last breath at exactly the same moment for God, but not for us. We get to live in between those moments. So it's a confusing thing, and so we can talk about it a little bit, but that's why we're not supposed to contemplate it a lot, because it does just make you confused. The more you think about it, the more confusing it gets. God's omnipotence. So God's all-powerfulness. God certainly has a direction that he wants to bring the planet towards. And in the end, there is going to be world peace, and there's going to be everybody working with synergy, and the Messiah is going to come, and all the problems are going to be solved, and it's going to be fabulous. No question about it. And yet, we're all part of the plan, and we all get to choose within that plan what role we'd like to play or not play. That's up to us. So, but it is going there, and God is taking us there. So then what's the point of us doing anything, or how does free will work in that? So we do have a concept of a grand sweep of history. There is a destiny that it's going towards. And then God makes space, and really it is God making space, because he's all-powerful. He could do whatever he wants, right? He actually pulls his will back to allow space for our will to exist. Pulls his power back. Really has to pull his will back and his power back at the same time, pulls his power back through pulling his will back to allow us the opportunity to do certain things. So if we choose good or we choose bad, God for sure wants us to choose good. God doesn't want us to choose murder. God wants us to choose kindness, whatever it is. But we get to pick. Each one of us gets to pick every single day, many different times. If we yell at somebody, if we act with kindness towards somebody, if we give charity, if we withhold it, you know, if we buy an extra whatever it is, or we give that money to somebody who could use it better than a second cashmere sweater or whatever it is that we might want, right? So that's up to us. We get to make those moral decisions on a daily basis. So, but God could direct us towards that, right? So there's, I can't remember if last week we discussed a poor person at the door. Did we talk about one in our community, our right-wing religious community, and maybe you've experienced it too, we have tzedakah collectors that come knocking on the door. And they come from all around the world, mostly from Israel, but from New York, and sometimes from other countries as well. And they have lists of the Jews in the different cities, and they come knocking on the door, and they ask you for tzedakah, for whatever it is. They're running a yeshiva, or they're marrying off their daughter, or their aunt needs surgery, or whatever it is. They have all kinds of different things. Some seem more legitimate than other requests. You know, I get frustrated personally when somebody comes to the door and says, I'm marrying off my child and I need money to buy her an apartment in Jerusalem. I don't have money to buy an apartment in Jerusalem. Why should I give you money to buy an apartment in Jerusalem? And yet in Israel, that's what you do. You buy an apartment for your child when they get married. That's how it works. And so they need that money, right? So, but the question is really, what is that person doing there at my door? Do I need to give them money? Am I helping them when I do? So the answer of our philosophers is no. I'm not helping them, and I don't need to for them. I need to for me. They're coming to the door as an opportunity for me. It's not God made us and made the money that we have. God could make that person have more money or find a diamond in the street. No problem. If that person just needs an apartment, God could arrange that for that person. So why are they at my door? I'm not going to write them a $400,000 check for that apartment. I'm going to write them a $10 check because that's what I give to people who come to my door, right? I used to like listen to the stories and decide who gets what, and then I finally realized this is getting way over my tzedakah budget here. Like, I have organizations that I want to, you know, give impactful donations to, or at least for me, primary donations, $100, $500 to certain organizations here. I don't need to be thinking, is it 5, is it 10, is it 18, is it 101? 101's a Sephardic number, right? What are you giving to each person who's coming to the door? Now I just have to give a straight 10. Everybody who comes gets 10. So, but what I have to realize is that the exercise is for me. I need to work on my generosity by handing that $10. It has nothing to do with what they need. It has everything to do with what I need. I need to make a choice to engage. And then I have to remember each time. Sometimes, let's say I'm preparing a class. I think last week it happened. I was preparing this class. Somebody came to the door. My son called me up. I knew it was somebody at the door for money. I just wrote a check, gave it to him. I said, please tell him, bracha natzlacha, give it to him at the door. All right, so I chose not to engage. What did I get out of that? Nothing. You know, I gave away 10 bucks, but I didn't give the guy a smile. I didn't go downstairs and gauge. I didn't hand it to myself. I didn't give the way I should have for my own exercise of gift. I just acquitted myself, right? So it's really an opportunity each time to engage in the giving for my own exercise of who I am using my free will. So God arranges the world. God could choose who has money and who doesn't. And God allows us, God creates poor people. People in any type of need, whether somebody's sick or poor or lonely or sad, whatever it is, creates people who have needs and people who have what to give them. So let's say I don't have money, but I have a smile. I have a bracha. I could give that generously, right? So we all have things that other people need. So the question is, why do people need? It's for us to be able to give. Right? And why do we need? It's for other people to be able to give to us. I was thinking about that with the Lebanon war, the recent war that we had 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, the land of Israel, in a way, is a, I don't want to use this word except for there's not a good word for it, really. It's like a magic land. It's a spiritually reactive land. It only allows the right people to live in it, which is why now it's completely populated by Jews, and while the Jews were gone, it was not populated hardly at all. Right, so the nation that can live there is the Jewish people. However, the Jewish people, as we are today, were not exactly the people that the land wants. So every once in a while, the land starts to heave and wants to kick us out because we don't spiritually mesh with it. So what happened in that Lebanon war? All kinds of people were displaced, and all kinds of people took them in. Jews opened their homes and their hearts and their pocketbooks and gave away food and money and rooms in their house and gave people drives and hugs and clothes. And I mean, they shared, and we shared too, even from here. We sent checks and we worried about people and we thought about people. And even people here who own real estate there said, a family could live in my apartment in Jerusalem. Two families could live there while I'm here. Right? We shared. It generated a tremendous amount of kindness, which flipped us back into being able to live in the land. That's my personal opinion on why that war happened, right? What was going on there? We need to be people of kindness. If we're not living in kindness, we need a little push to help us live in kindness. Anyway, so it's about our free will. That's why people need, so that we can choose to give or not. So God certainly has the power to do anything he wants. Nobody has to need anything. Nobody has to be able to be cruel, right? God could prevent any abusive parent from raising their hand, let alone letting that hand slam down on a child, right? God can totally do that, but that would take away a human being's free will. And so God steps back and says, even though what you're doing is against what I desire, and even though I have the power to stop you, I choose to step back and create space so that your free will can operate in this environment, so that you can then choose to shape yourself into a godlike creature or not. That's what we get to do. So hashgacha pratis then, let's move into that. So that's really destiny. There is a destiny. God will take us there for sure. We get to choose our role in that destiny. We could be on the side. We could be active players. We're for sure going to get there. That's not a question. The Jewish people will survive, whether or not you choose to be a part of it. But you could choose to be a part of it. You could choose to be a transformative member of it. That's up to you. But whether or not it's going to survive, that's up to God. So that's destiny. That's omnipotence. That's omniscience and hashgacha pratis, God's intervention into our lives. Actual intervention. We do understand that God intervenes in our lives. So where's our free will? Right? I pull out of the parking lot, and as I'm pulling out, I didn't notice that somebody's pulling out behind me. So I smack into them. Didn't happen this time. Thank God. But I smack into them, right? So now what? They're driving a BMW. I'm driving an old Subaru, right? And now I caused thousands of dollars, even if I just nicked their fender, it's a BMW, right? That's 10 grand, right? So now, how am I supposed to deal with that? There's all kinds of other hashgacha pratises. So maybe I was supposed to lose $10,000. Maybe. It's possible. I cheated on my taxes. And so it was ordained at Rosh Hashanah. I'm supposed to earn X. But I cheated. So now I have X plus 10 grand because I cheated. Right? No, you don't get X plus 10 grand. You get X. Right? But you're going to have to lose it. Not only don't you get the money now because you have to spend it on the fender, but you have to take time off of work and figure it out and insurance, and actually your insurance rates are going to go up, so maybe you're going to lose more, whatever it is. So there's hashgacha pratis to make things work out. So free will. Where's free will now? Did I have free will to get into that accident or not? No, I don't. I do have free will, though, as to how I deal with it. That's where my free will is. So free will is not about our circumstances in life. You don't have free will whether you're sick or healthy. You get to choose to eat healthier, do healthier things, but we all know people who are at the health food store every other day, and they look horrible, right? And there are people who are eating ice cream and bomba all day long without a vegetable in their life, and they are the picture of robust health, right? So not fair, right? So it's not all that either. So the hashgacha pratis is God's direct intervention in our life. Things happen, but God does that to provide us with circumstances. We get to choose how we behave in the circumstances. Now let's look at the two lines that I put here. Because we have two, in a way, contradictory things going on in the Talmud. It says, everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. So that makes sense. Everything's in God's hands, except we get to decide if we fear God or not, or we have awe of God or not. God doesn't intervene there. Okay, but how does that work with this statement? Everything's in the hands of God except chills and fevers. So chills and fevers sounds like part of the everything. Do you get to pick if you're sick or not? So it's interesting. The commentary on this, I'll read you what Tosfos says here on the second one. I'll read you both of them. So I think we read last time, and I printed it last time, the Rashi on the first one. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Rashi says, everything is in the hands of heaven except which occurs to a person. Everything which occurs to a person is from God. For instance, whether a person is tall, short, poor, rich, smart, dull, light, dark, all of this is from heaven. But whether a person is righteous or evil is not from heaven. This is given into the hands of the individual, and there are two paths before him, and he needs to choose fear of God. Okay, so that's now saying sick and healthy, also wealthy or poor, also in the hands of heaven. Now we have this next statement, everything's in the hands of heaven except chills and fever. So what does Tosfos say about that? This is an interesting thought. Everything's in the hands of heaven. This means that things like lions and thieves and other bad occurrences are decrees from heaven. But chills and fevers, these aren't decrees because one can't avoid them. Certainly, if someone wishes to kill himself by jumping into a fire or river, he can, even though there is no decree that he should die. This is different than the concept of everything's in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven, because that refers to a person's attributes, whether he's strong or weak, rich or poor, tall or short, wise or dull. But this refers to events which occur to a person. So, let's look at this for a second, because what he's really saying is something deeper here. Events that occur to a person can be channeled by our actions. So, whether you're sick or healthy could be a spiritual consequence of something that you've engaged in. So not that you didn't cover up when you went outside after a shower, right? Not that you went out with your hair wet, right? And everybody says you catch pneumonia, right? Not that. But that you were unkind to somebody and that opened you up to a spiritual malady which manifests as a cold or a fever. And that was up to you, the kindness or unkindness. So we get to choose how we want to behave towards people, and that choice makes a difference as to what things will occur to us.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So I have read that there's a popular opinion that certain kinds of cancer are caused by internalized anger, and there's some statistic of
Well, so yes and no. So let's just say this for now. Let's turn the clock back 2,500 years. I saw a really funny cartoon in the New Yorker of two people walking out of their house, and it was like fields and cavemen. And the husband says to the wife, "Honey, I think we turned our clock back too far." So we turn it back an hour, but let's for this for 1 minute turn it back 2,500 years. Right, 2,500 years ago, during the era of prophecy, there was a stronger spiritual-physical connection than there is today. So I'm going to speak in that paradigm first, and then we'll fast forward to today. So at that time, which is not the same way as it is now, if somebody engaged in particular averas, particular transgressions, they would make themselves susceptible to particular physical maladies. The clearest one that we know about for sure is Lashon Hara. So if somebody spoke evil about somebody else or about the nation of Israel or about the land of Israel or about groups in Israel, different, let's say if somebody says those Benjaminites, you know, that tribe, they're, you know, so whatever, right? So even speaking about a certain group, even if it's true, but speaking negatively, that's Lashon Hara. So if a person spoke Lashon Hara, the first thing that would happen to them is that their house would get spots on it. We might call it mildew. It might have looked like mildew, but spots would go on the house. There are specific spots that were clearly, well, you couldn't tell necessarily yourself. You would call a Kohen who would diagnose the house and say, "You have a spiritual malady, do tshuva." Let's say you didn't. Now it goes to your clothes, right? And now you're supposed to call the Kohen because you see the spots on your clothes. But you didn't, or you didn't do tshuva, and now it goes to your skin, right? So, and then once it goes to your skin, you're tamei. There's a ritual impurity that you're subject to as well because of that physical manifestation of the spiritual malady on you. You now have to go through a whole ritual process to take care of it. But it's a tshuva process. So you're having a physical manifestation of a spiritual ailment, right? So your spiritual ailment is negative feelings towards people that was then manifest in your speech. So now you're going to have some kind of breach in your skin too. So that's really what this is talking about, is that there's other things too. Let's say you looked at somebody unkindly, right? Or you were a little jealous when you shouldn't have been, or you held a grudge when you shouldn't have, or you, whatever it is, there's all kinds of things that you could do that are inappropriate. You wore shatnez when you shouldn't have, right? Shatnez is a mix of linen and wool together in one garment that you're not allowed to. So who knows? There's all kinds of ramifications of the different things that we do, the physical pathways that we embark on, whether consciously or unconsciously, have spiritual consequences, right? So that's what a mitzvah is a physical pathway that has a spiritual consequence. There's other physical pathways that have spiritual consequences as well, and certainly transgressions have consequences that then can. So we have this physical spiritual connection. The connection is made by physical behavior. So when people behave a certain way, there's a spiritual result that happens, but then it comes back into the physical as well. So somebody who, let's say, is feeling very spiritually connected or is living a life of continued spiritual elevation and connection, you do see in those people a shine in their face, a light in their step, a kindness that's expressed that's different than some other people. You can sometimes feel that in the presence of somebody who is a worked out spiritual person. There's maybe not so many of those today, and maybe some of them aren't so manifest today, but still we have all, I think, experienced some type of that. Just in looking at somebody, sometimes you can see, you know, the kindness in somebody, even if they're a stranger. You can often see something. So that was then. Now, moving forward to now, we don't have a strong connection at all. So we are never, ever permitted to ask ourselves about somebody else, but we should just ask about ourselves, but never assume, what is the root of this physical thing that I'm struggling with? So you might say, why do I have a cold sore? Maybe I am speaking incorrectly about people. Why do I have a sore throat? Maybe I'm swallowing things I shouldn't be swallowing. Right? You're supposed to ask. You are not supposed to answer. You ask and do research for yourself and yourself alone, never for somebody else. So you never look at somebody else and say, why do they have cancer? They probably hate people. You know, you never, ever should do that. But for yourself, you should ask. Now, the reason why you don't answer for yourself is because we do not have that direct connection today. We don't. So you can't know. And it's not clear that it's even from that. You know, there are times that it is just from living in the place where they poisoned the wells and you're drinking from that well water and now you're sick. But why do you live there? Right? There's a reason you live there. So for whatever reason it is, whether it's a past life or possibly even a future life, for some reason you need to be there. Maybe you need to be there because your family has to give to you after you get sick. Right? So maybe you're the vehicle of the giving that has to come out of your family. So maybe it's not about a punishment at all. It's about the fact that you're the vehicle for your whole family to be givers. So that's why we don't ever answer that question for ourselves, but we should look. Now, it's much more physical just to say anger can cause certain kinds of cancer. Anger can cause ulcers, right? So ulcers could be bacterial. Bacterial could develop into cancers, whatever it is. So that's possible. And yes, I think we do need to be looking at that connection today and from a spiritual point of view as well. I know that's like, you know, depending on who's listening here, so I'm now going from allopathic to complementary. I prefer complementary medicine than alternative medicine, right? So complementary medicine would say, yeah, look at the whole body. But we're not just a body, we're a soul too. So look at the soul too. So you have to look at the body, you have to look at the brain, you have to look at the whole person. So in that sense, it is up to us how we will have certain things. So certain things will happen because we've opened the door for those certain things to happen. So whether it's physically or spiritually. Okay, so that's why everything's in the hands of heaven except for chills and fevers, because chills and fevers are just an example of what might come our way depending on how we behave. And we get to choose how we behave, so then we get to choose the circumstances that those types of circumstances that we'll find ourselves in. Okay, now let's talk about for a minute the attitude towards Bechira, attitude that should come from understanding this more. So God gets to pick what happens to us. We get to pick how we behave inside what happens to us, right? So whether we got into that car accident or not, whether I backed into that BMW or not, maybe I didn't get to pick that. But I do get to pick if I get out and exchange insurance information, if I take responsibility for it, if I apologize nicely, or if I start to yell at them. That's my choice, right? I get to choose all of that within the situation. So, but whether it happened or not, let's say my car was backed into. So now I have to decide, how am I going to handle this person? So let's look at these two different, did I give you? Yeah, I gave them to you too. Okay, so here's the first one from Nachmanides. Know and understand that just because a person is condemned to death on Rosh Hashanah, the bandits who kill him will not be free of judgment because they did to him what was decreed to occur. The victim will die from his sins, but the murderer will also be held accountable for his blood. So, a person's decreed, death is decreed for that person. They could die in a number of ways. They could drive off a cliff, nobody has to kill them, right? But the murderer chose through their other behavior to now channel the death of this person. So now that person's decreed to die, and this person's negative behavior put the two of them together that this person's going to kill that person. That person was supposed to die. Right? So, but the murderer didn't have to kill that person. That person could have died another way. They could have slipped and fell in the bathroom and died. Right? So the murderer is held accountable for murdering. It doesn't let him off the hook. Just because that person was supposed to die doesn't mean that person's off the hook. So even if I'll say, well, the BMW was supposed to be damaged, right? That doesn't let me off the hook for damaging it. Yes, that person has to suffer and send their car into the shop. That's separate from my responsibility to pay for it, right? I'm supposed to lose the money. So I'm not allowed to take an attitude and say, well, you were supposed to have that damage. Live with it, right? No. Okay, now let's see the flip side. Right? So I just gave you the tachlis here because I wanted to give you enough space to write notes on the paper, so I'll read you the whole thing. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. So this is in Egypt when Joseph is about to reveal himself. The brothers don't yet know who he is. Come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, imagine how they're feeling at that moment. Oh my gosh, the viceroy of Egypt is Joseph. We're in big trouble now, right? They're all standing there shaking, petrified. And he says, and now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save the lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh. Pharaoh, father of me? I don't know. Lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. So, Yosef here totally gets it, right? Yes, they were the vehicle. And yes, they will have to pay their price. That's between them and God. But between him and them, he's not holding a grudge. Because he totally gets. His job was to be here in Egypt. He had what to do. Somehow he had to get there. He got there. So he doesn't blame his brothers for it. They still have to take responsibility for what they did. But he's telling them, I'm not holding it against you. I totally get. I needed to be here. And so relax from my side. I won't take revenge. Now, I'm sure you know, just parenthetically, or maybe you don't, on Yom Kippur, we read the story of the ten martyrs. Right? Are you familiar with that story? It's a very sad story in the afternoon of Yom Kippur where we read about 10 sages of Israel who were killed in very brutal ways, and it really talks about the whole horrible way each one died. And it's a whole Gemara that talks about, they actually lived in different time periods, but the Gemara talks about what happened was Caesar called these sages into him and said, what's the punishment for kidnapping? And they answer, death. And he says, well, what about the 10 brothers of Joseph who kidnapped and weren't killed? And I said, well, they weren't killed. He says, well, you guys have to pay. I'm going to kill you in their stead. And so they're all killed. Right? So it's a whole long story. It's on Yom Kippur, but they're killed in the stead of the 10 brothers who were not killed. How does that work? We do have some kind of stuff about dying for other sins in Judaism. It's not just Christian. It's not that one person could die to save a whole, you know, that doesn't work. That's not Jewish at all. But that one could die for somebody else. That can possibly be the case. It's a whole long philosophic discussion, and not for now. Anyway, those 10 martyrs were from the 10 brothers. Okay, so now we have these two things. We see the attitude that we should have, that we have to take total responsibility for what we engage in, but we shouldn't blame others for harming us because we're supposed to be that way, whatever it is. So if we can work on that, balancing those two inside of us. Okay, so now that we've done this, that's more nature. Now let's do nurture of free will. So how do we nurture our free will? How do we grow our ability to make choices in a free way? So the first thing is awareness. We have to cultivate within ourselves the awareness that we do have freedom to choose. So I found this nice quote in a Stephen Covey book. I'll read to you. The range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change until we notice how failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds. Right? So here's our opportunity to notice that we failed to notice. And that's where teachers can come in handy. Friends, teachers, peers can come in handy, is helping point out to us, and we can invite them to help us in this journey of when we're failing to notice something, because that does limit us. You can't go somewhere you don't know exists, right? So, you know, if somebody says, where in the world would you like to go? So I could think about different places. I've seen National Geographic, and you know, I've thought of travel brochures, and I could think. But if you ask an African villager whose job it is to get potatoes out of the ground, where do you want to go? I want to go to the well where there's clean water. You know, like, where? Don't you want to see the Panama Canal? Like something? They never heard of it. So they're limited by their knowledge. So we're also limited by our knowledge and what we've noticed in the world. So the first thing that we need is awareness that we have free will and we can develop our freedom in that. Last week I gave you a quote which I didn't reprint. Where is it? From Viktor Frankl. Did I reprint it on mine? Oh gosh, maybe I didn't on my cheat sheet that I have. Oh yeah. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So one way that we can nurture our free will is to increase that space between stimulus and response. So that's the initial count to 10 strategy when people say, if you get angry before you say anything, count to 10. Okay, so increase the space between stimulus and response. But the first thing to do is start to notice, what's the stimulus for that response? Oh, I'm responding. What stimulated me to respond that way? Start to make a connection between stimulus and response. See if there is a space there. Now, that actually takes an engaged process and something that we often don't do today outside of a classroom, which is think. I mean, a lot of times we don't. I actually once was discussing with a particular class on the importance of thinking and cultivating thought and creating space to think in your life, even if it's for 5 minutes a day, but making sure that there's space to think. So somebody raised her hand and said, what should we think about? And I thought, oh my gosh, we're so much further gone than I thought. So there's a lot to think about, but you can't really cultivate who you are without taking that time for cultivation. That's the law of the harvest. You're not going to get crops unless you plant seeds, right? And even if you plant seeds, unless there's rain and sun and time, you're not going to get crops. So first you have to plant the seeds. So the seeds are desire. Desire to use your free will in a free way, right? Desire to have freedom to choose. So you have to know you have it and then desire to exercise the freedom. That's the seed. And then you have to cultivate it. Start noticing. What's the stimulus? What's the response? And then think about it, especially when you make a response you don't like or you're not proud of. Say, how could I have responded differently? Now, maybe in the moment you can't think of that, but you certainly can, and this is where the thinking comes in, at the end of the day. Review. Gosh, there was a response I didn't like. What was stimulated me? How could I have backed it up so I wouldn't have responded that way? How would I have liked to respond? And then practice it. Run it through in your mind. How might you respond? Right? And even maybe say a sentence that helps you respond, especially if it's something that happens regularly, a regular breakdown around dinner time or whatever it is, coming home from work or calling your mom or whatever it is, something that happens kind of regularly. So practice. You might even say it out loud so that you've actually practiced the response you want to have, so that you have it, so you have the freedom to choose that. So awareness is important, direction, where you're headed. What do you want to accomplish? You can't achieve a goal unless you set a goal. So you need to set a direction for yourself. Use my choices freely. Have freedom to use it. Don't be kept prisoner by my instinct. All right, we have a lot of instinctual responses, but we can choose out of them. That's up to us. So, but we first have to know that, and we second have to desire that, and then we have to set it really as a goal, not just want it, but actually say, I'm going to work on this. And then strategies. So now we have to figure out some strategies. So that's part of what this article that I brought you is about, is some of the strategies, understanding the mechanism of free will better. So he starts with that article on smoking, and Rav Dessler was a smoker, and he quit in the end. But I think he used that because it was particularly difficult for him. Now, this was before he smoked, before we really understood how bad it is for you. I'm sure he would have stopped sooner. But he does give the example of a smoker who wakes up at night with chest pains, right, and then resolves in the middle of the night, I am never smoking another cigarette. Gets that there's a connection between the smoking and the chest pains and resolves in the middle of the night, never touching it again. In the morning, he wakes up, right, and pretty soon he wants a cigarette, right? And so he thinks to himself, well, just one's not going to hurt. So he has just the one. And then a couple minutes later or hours later, whatever his timing is, right, another one can't hurt. So he says, what is that? He says, clearly we know for a fact that one leads to another. How is it that we're allowing ourselves to believe that just one won't hurt? Right? What's standing in between these two sets of opinions? And he says, it's us, right? We are the one that makes the choice where we want to go. It is a choice, right? So we just have to recognize that that's the choice. But we do allow ourselves, we create those tricks for ourselves, right? That just this won't matter. Just this one brownie won't matter. Just the skipping this one workout won't matter. Just this one cash no tax won't matter. Whatever it is, when it does, and we know it, but we allow ourselves to be tricked there. So we create the tricks for ourselves there. So we need strategies to help with that too. So some of them are to make your goal very clear and then meditate on the goal. There's lots of Jewish types of meditation. If you're familiar with some non-Jewish types of meditation, they may be Jewish anyway and you just didn't know that.
Doesn't help. You have to have the will to stop.
Well, you have to have the will. All right, so you have to, how do you increase your will?
Yeah.
So let's say your will is weak.
I stopped 1974. 2 years later, I had a bad dream. Never started again.
Huh. That's good.
You had to have a strong will.
I think you do have to have a strong will. Smoking is particularly difficult. I think a physical addiction is particularly difficult. But let's say it's not a physical addiction. Let's say it's something that you're regular at. Overspending what you earn, right? Putting it on a credit card. Everybody knows a credit card's not a credit card. It's a debt card, right? Every time you swipe it, you just increase your debt. Everybody knows that. But the credit card companies are very smart, and they call them credit cards, as if you have credit there. Or like life insurance, right? It used to be called death insurance when they first started selling it. They're insuring you for death. Nobody wants to say, I'm going to die and buy death insurance. They buy life insurance to insure your life, right? So we have to first recognize what it is that we're dealing with and then set our strong goal. But then we do need to bring that goal back. That's one reason why davening is a Jewish meditation, right? Or benching, right? So every time we say, rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild Jerusalem. We're saying, Jerusalem's important to me. Oh yeah, Jerusalem's important to me. Oh yeah, I live in Denver, but Jerusalem's important to me. We have to remind ourselves, or otherwise Jerusalem might not be important to us. We have to say it again and again and again. And all the other things that we say, again and again and again, it brings it back. So, affirmation. You might want to actually pick something that you're working on free will with and say, I choose to exercise my free will in this realm about whatever that you're working on. Or I just choose to exercise freedom in my decisions more frequently. Or you can come up with any kind of mantra or something that works with you. One of the things that I use in my life, which I've spoken to Stella about, is my concept of skip step two. Skip step two works for a lot of different things, but it can work here too, in increasing that distance between stimulus and response, where you have that freedom then. So step two is the frustration in your life, right? So step one, something bad happens. Something frustrating happens, whatever it is. You lose money, you trip, you miss your flight, you photocopy things upside down when you meant to photocopy them the right way, right? So, and now you stress about it. Ugh, I can't believe I forgot to photocopy that page, right? But meanwhile, you still have to bring the pages to the class improperly photocopied. So skip step two. Step three is you have to deal with it, whatever it is, right? You still have to hand out the photocopies like they are. You don't have time to redo it, and you're not going to waste all that paper, right? Step one, you photocopied mistakes. Step two, you stress about it. Step three, you hand them out anyway. Skip step two. Why stress about it, right? So now that's just a practice in life, skip step two. But once you practice doing it, you see stimulus, response, space. Right? Step two. So I think I said once when I explained this, my daughter said, why don't you just skip step one? It's so much smarter. Right? So it is so much smarter to skip step one, skip the stressful thing. However, stress happens. So skipping step two is just a practice. If you use that as a mantra, which works for me anyway, and some people that I've taught it to or shared it with, if you use that as a mantra, you just start skipping that stress point in between. Now, does it mean you're not stressed about it at all? Maybe not right away. But it does give you space to start working on it. Hello. So just having the mantra of skipping it, you start with little things like photocopy. Does that really make a difference? It doesn't. But missing your flight does. Right? So in the airport, you just decide, I'm skipping step two. Anyway, I have to catch a later flight. Anyway, the fact that it was windy in Chicago, this happened to me, and I landed late, right, because no fault of my own, I got on my right plane, but then it didn't land on time in Chicago, which means I missed my connection to Newark, which means I missed the flight to Israel, which means I missed that speaking engagement that night in Jerusalem. skip step two. There's nothing you can do about it. Why be stressed and have to miss everything, right? Don't be stressed and just arrive when you get there. So it's a very helpful strategy. Start practicing it with small things till you get good at it. But then you can see, once you realize that there's step two, that's your space between stimulus and response. So it's a great stress reducer in your life, skip step two, but it also helps you practice seeing the distance, seeing the stimulus, and seeing the response, what's going on. Oh, I'm responding this way to that. Let me skip that and choose a different response. Right? So skipping it is actually making a choice in that moment. I'm going to choose a different response. I'm just going to deal with this responsibly, however I can. One of the things that Stephen Covey points out is that once you take responsibility for making your choices, you become response-able. You're able to choose your response. So, and that's what we want, is the ability to choose our response rather than just to slide into it, however that brings us. So then in order to, so those are some strategies. There's other strategies, which you might find in the article that I gave you. But then you want to set your goal. So your ultimate goal for all of this is to become more godlike. God gets to choose with total freedom. And we're created in the image of God. So we have the ability to choose with total freedom, but we have to take that ability. So as we choose healthy choices, we develop ourselves and become more and more godlike. So in the end, the way we said, God made a space for our will. He held his power back and holds his will back to create space for our free will to function. So in emulating God, we can also hold our will back sometimes to create space for God. We live inside God, and we can create space for God to live inside us. So there's a reciprocity there. That's how we become God-like also. So God had to contract God's self to create physical space and psychic space in this world for us to exist. And then we have an ego that fills our whole selves up. We can choose to move our ego out of the way to create space for God to live inside us. So we live inside God. God lives inside us. He makes space for us. We make space for him. And in that way, we emulate God. So, and that's really the goal, is to actually actualize our image of God. So that's why I put on here on the bottom of your sheet, make me a sanctuary and I will dwell. I think we spoke about this once. Make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell. It should be in it. But it's make for me a sanctuary. I will dwell amongst you. Through engaging in this physical pathway of building the sanctuary, you will transform yourself, not space, yourself, into something that God can live inside. And that's really what God wants. Do something physical to create space for me. And that will help you actualize your image of God. So that's it. Any questions? Well, if you think of any questions, I won't be here next week, but you can email me or call me. Feel free.
Next week?